Welcome to the People I Meet podcast. I am your host, Dean Crositz. Today you get to meet my new friend, Dr. Clint Haycock. Clint has a doctorate in Old Testament and homiletics. You'll learn what those things are. And he is also the host of the Mind Shift podcast, which is how I met him. And we will talk a little bit about the Mind Shift podcast and what it is about in the interview. So let's just go ahead and get right to it. Let's meet Dr. Clint Haycock. Dr. Clint Haycock, welcome to the People I Meet podcast.
Thanks, Dean. Nice to be chatting with you once again.
Yes, it's I'm glad to have you back. For those of you who don't know, Clint was kind enough to have me on his podcast and pick my brain about about my Christian career, why I left the faith, and a little bit about Dominion theology. So make sure you check that out over on the Mind Shift podcast, everywhere podcasts are listened to.
So that's true.
So Dr. Clint, you are a doctor. You have a doctorate in what?
What exactly? Okay, so I did my doctorate in Old Testament studies as well as preaching. So homiletics. My idea was I was going through my progressive Christian phase at the time, my sort of last gasp. I was going to save the church from within. So my goal was to combine my love for the Old Testament with preaching, which I was also interested in studying kind of from like a postmodern point of view. I was hoping to introduce this whole new preaching style that was going to revitalize the church, and it didn't work. The short version is nobody cared. Nobody wanted to hear my theory. So I did my doctorate, and that was pretty much the end of it.
It's difficult to be a trailblazer, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Well, I knew I was in trouble because you have your oral exam, which in this country, they call it a viva. So I had my viva, which is the final big oral exam sort of thing. And when you pass that, you get your degree. So you've submitted your paperwork. I did like a 260 page thesis, took me almost 4 years to write it. The first thing the guy said, he was a fundamentalist who came up from a Bible college in London. And he said, the first thing was, I want to fail you because I would never, ever recommend preaching this way in a church. I wouldn't do it, and I don't think anyone else should. That was his first statement, and I knew I was in trouble, so it was downhill from there. It was a very rough, he mauled me for 2.5 hours, basically. Luckily, the internal supervisor from the college or the university I went to saved my ass, and he got me through with major revisions, but I squeaked through by the skin of my teeth. So it was brutal. Yeah, it really was.
So we're going to come back to that as we learn about your life, as we go through your story. So
yep.
So let's make sure we put a pin there and make sure that we come back to that when we get there. Before we get started, I always like to tell people how we met, and I want to make sure I get this right. I found your podcast, the Mind Shift podcast, and I was listening to it, and I was like, wow, this guy and I have similar backgrounds, and we made similar decisions regarding our ministry careers. And he's covering, at the time you were really covering a lot of Dominion theology, which I knew a little bit about. Mm-hmm. So I think I just emailed you on Twitter. I just sent you a
message. That's right.
Hey, let's talk. And we ended up talking, and you were kind enough to have me on your podcast. And then now I get to have you on mine. So
yeah, very cool. No. We got a lot of good feedback from that episode, by the way. Oh. A lot of people that responded on both my YouTube channel as well as emails and DMs on Twitter saying, oh, I'm an ex-charismatic too. Everything Dean was talking about totally resonated. And it's very triggering, actually. Some people said, wow.
I mean, oh, no.
In a good way, though, that the stuff you were talking about, describing how you got out and things that happened to you in your church experience, were pretty traumatic. And a lot of people resonated with that. So thanks for sharing your story. That was really good.
Well, my pleasure. If it helps at least one person, then we're good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It did. And people in our Facebook group want you to come back for our Zoom call, I think in February. So we're going to book that, aren't we, at some point?
I think it's already booked. right?
Yeah, maybe it is. I guess it is. Yeah,
Yeah.
so we're going to do that. I'm looking forward to that. I think you're going to love meeting the people in our group as well.
I look forward to that. I I think you're familiar with this as well, you and your wife both. It gets pretty lonely when you first leave.
That it does.
And
And it can
sometimes
stay
it
that
stays
way.
lonely. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You
Yeah.
need to
So.
find a new community. That's one of the biggest things, isn't it? Form a new tribe or whatever you need to do to rebuild. Because a lot of the things, people coming out of church, isn't it? You have an incredible sense of community. And that's one of the big things that you lose leaving church, leaving religion behind. And then what do you replace it with? Some people never do. And that's kind of, we need community. Humans need community. It's absolutely true, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is look at all of our closest cousins. And this just occurred to me in the last couple of weeks. Also the animals that we are able to domesticate, they're all social animals as well. We're not good at domesticating animals that are loners, right?
That's true. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, we have dogs and cats and pets that we can snuggle with, and they want to be around us and they want to be near us. It doesn't really matter what we're doing. They just
Yeah.
want to be in the same room or doing what we're doing. And it's so true. Even animals need that companionship, don't they? And we love that unconditional love we get from them.
Yeah. Yeah, we do.
Or need
Absolutely.
it, really,
Yeah.
actually. I mean, I
Yeah.
come home every day and here comes our dog running and she's so happy to see me. And you think, she doesn't care what I look like, if I'm hideously ugly or beautiful or whatever, it doesn't matter. She just
Right.
loves me as a person.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why a lot of therapists have people get dogs or
Sure.
cats.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so people leaving religion can really struggle, I think, when they, like you say, there's a lot of being alone, feeling alone after you leave church or whatever you're doing behind. It can be hugely traumatic.
Absolutely. All right. So, Clint, where are you from originally?
Born and raised in Seattle, Washington. That's my hometown, just south of Seattle. That's my origins right there.
And are you an only child? Do you have siblings?
I am not an only child. I'm the youngest of six. I have five older sisters, so I'm the youngest chronologically, but I'm the only boy. So I had a really strange upbringing in that respect that my parents, they didn't really treat me like the baby of the family. Weirdly, I was treated more like the firstborn son because I technically was, even though I was the youngest. So I had a real weird mix going on there in terms of birth order.
Okay, and so were your parents good Catholics, good Mormons, good having all those
None
kids?
of the above. They were good fundamentalist Christians. Yeah, I grew up in Church of Christ from day one. The minute I was born, I was in church. Every week, Wednesday night services, Sunday night services, Sunday morning services. My dad was an elder. He played on the worship band. He was a piano player. He led worship. I mean, he was heavily involved. My mom taught Sunday school. I mean, we were all in summer camp every year, Christian camp, you name it, youth group. We were there two, three, four times a week.
I did that to my kids too.
Yep. Same with me.
Okay, and so you grew up in a fundamentalist Christian home. I've heard you describe it as a cult.
Yes,
Is
it
there
was.
a reason that you believe you grew up in a cult?
Well, just from a point of view of the fundamentalism itself, that can be very cult-like, the teachings, the doctrine, the very high control elements of it. But then my parents got into the Bill Gothard movement, which was then known as the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts. It's now called Institute in Basic Life Principles, IBLP. But they were heavily involved in that movement. When I was probably 8 or 9, they got really into it, and I was raised in that. They tried to raise us according to Bill Gothard's teachings, which I see now was absolutely a cult and still is. It's still going.
When you were, did you go to public school or were you homeschooled? Were you in private schools?
I went to public school up until about 4th grade, and we made a switch then. Me and my older sister, Beth, she was just above me. We went to a Christian school from 5th grade, and then I went ahead and graduated all the way through high school in Seattle. So yeah, from 5th grade all the way to 12th grade, I was in Christian school.
Okay. And when you were in high school, did you play sports? Were
Oh yeah. I was a huge sports guy. Soccer was my game, or football, as they call it in this country. I played baseball, a little bit of basketball, but soccer was my main sport. I played soccer from when I was 5 or 6 and always loved it. I thought I was going to go on to hopefully get a scholarship and all the rest of it. And of course, that didn't work out. Some people I knew did, but I didn't. It didn't happen for me.
Okay. When you were in high school, what were you planning to do as a career?
You know, that's the thing. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had this vague notion that I should maybe be a teacher, but academically, I was really struggling my first couple of years. So I was having a real problem fitting in because I'd come from this tiny Christian school. I think there were 5 of us that graduated in 8th grade. And here I am now in 9th grade. I went to this Christian school, which only had about 300 kids. But I mean, going from a school of a couple hundred from, kindergarten through 8th grade to a giant, in my view, I struggled to fit in. So I didn't know what I was doing. I really had no clue. I thought that's why I thought I was going to play sports. I thought this is going to be my future. I wanted to be a star soccer player and get a, scholarship and all the rest of it. That didn't work out. So when I got out of high school, I ended up joining the Navy because I had nowhere to go. I was bumming around, unemployed, typical story. Dad was on my back, riding my ass. And I was talking to my cousin one day and he said, "Well, I'm joining the Navy." And I'm like, "Screw it, I'm going too." So I called the recruiter up and I said, "You've just signed up my cousin Dan. He's leaving in 2 weeks. I want to go with him to boot camp together." And the guy's like, "Get down to my office and we can totally get that done." So next thing I know, I'm on a plane going to San Diego, and I was spent 8 years in the Navy. So, that was a weird kind of last minute career decision that I didn't know I was signing up for, 8 years. You never think about it though when you're 18, 19 years old. Just sign whatever they put in front of you.
Right. And I did something similar. I did it on my own. I didn't join with a cousin or a friend or anything, but yeah, my mother drove me to school on senior skip day, and I was like, "Mom, come on." And she's like, "No, I made a deal with several of your teachers to get you to graduate high school
You're
and
gonna graduate
you're
over
going to
my dead
graduate."
body.
And she drove me to school, embarrassed me. And I went to school and like second or third period, I had gym class. And when gym class was over, I walked out the back door of the basketball court, the gymnasium, and walked down to the Air Force recruiter, and signed up. I was like, get me out of
Get me
here.
out of here.
Yeah.
They'll do that for you. They certainly got me out of there. It's funny because you look back on it now. I hated it at the time. All I could think about was getting out. I wanted to grow my hair back out. I was playing in metal bands when I left. I wanted to be a musician. That was my dream. I wanted to be a rock star, and I was a drummer in metal bands, Christian metal bands in Seattle. And yet now I can see I learned a lot of skills. I learned a lot of discipline. I got to travel. We went to Japan. We went to Korea. We got to go all over the place, and Uncle Sam was paying us for the privilege of traveling the world, So I learned a lot of skills and discipline. And now it's funny, what I do now is I teach military veterans building skills. So that's what I do for a job. And so I have that connection because I'm also a veteran, So I'm really grateful in a way for that time I spent in the Navy.
And what did you do in the Navy? What
I
was your
was an
job?
aviation structural mechanic, so I worked on airplanes. I was in a P-3 squadron, which was an anti-submarine warfare squadron out of Whidbey Island, Washington, the Naval Air Station up there. So that's what I did. I worked on all sorts of different aspects of airframes and, wheels, tires, brakes, sheet metal, riveting, all the rest of it, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so you were an airplane body man.
Pretty much, yeah. Hydraulics and tires and wheels and brakes and airframes and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a
I
good
was
skill.
I was a Russian translator.
Okay, as you do, someone's got to do it.
Yeah. All right. And you were in the Navy for 8 years, and when you got out, what did you do?
Oh man, I went off to Bible college not long afterwards. I did the thing. I grew my hair out. I was in bands as well. And we gave it one big last push. We were going to make it and become big rock stars. But that was around the time that in Seattle, the whole grunge music scene just exploded. And overnight, metal was dead. It was literally dead. We used to play clubs up and down, all the way down to Portland, up to Seattle, all over the place. We'd go to Spokane. We did gigs everywhere. And those places just shut down as soon as like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, all those huge bands came out. Metal was gone. And that was about the same time I decided that I was going to go off to Bible college and become a some sort of pastor or teacher. So we went down to Portland, took my me and my wife went down there, and that was it. I embarked on my new career as a some sort of pastor, teacher, whatever I was going to be.
Okay. And what did you major in by in when you, in your undergraduate Bible school?
Yeah, I graduated with a 4-year degree from this Bible college in Portland. My major was pastoral studies. So that was, it was funny because I remember on the first day they said, okay, you have to pick a major. And I'm going, what? I thought I was just here to study the Bible and theology. So of all the options, none of them sounded good to me except for the pastoral one. I didn't want to be a missionary. I didn't want to be a Greek scholar. I didn't want to be a music major. I just thought, well, I'll be a pastor then. So that's what I did. I studied pastoral ministry with a view towards, I was hopefully going to get into teaching. I thought, you know, if I could become a pastor for a few years first, you need to know what it's like in the trenches before you get off. Because I had, I'm sure you've come across people like this in Bible colleges, in seminaries. They've never served in a church in their lives at all, let alone had a real job. And so I always felt like they didn't know what it was like to be in ministry. And I thought, I want to have that credibility. So I ended up going off into this church in Portland, and I ended up staying there for about 12 years. I was on the worship team, then I became an elder, then I became the head elder, then the head pastor. And so I ended up staying there a lot longer than I had originally intended, but I definitely knew what it was like to be in the trenches. There's no doubt about it.
Okay. Yeah. one of the problems I had right away was, when I became a Christian at 21, my whole thing was, well, I want to do what Jesus did. And they're like, no. You go work in a restaurant, wash dishes, go do something you absolutely hate, and show that you can be faithful in the little things before you can be faithful in much. And I was like, wait, that's not what this says, right? And
Not what I'm reading.
a couple of these guys were terrorists and Jesus just put them to work.
That's right.
And they're like,
Amazing.
no, that's not how it works today. That's the
Why should it be any different though, you know? I don't understand that.
And I was I was just it was miserable from day one. It was literally square peg, round hole, right? Just I wasn't cut out for what they wanted me to do. And
That's
I was
amazing.
told, well, first you teach, you teach little kids Sunday school, and then you teach, middle schoolers or junior high, then you teach high school youth group, you become a youth pastor, and then you become a pastor. And I was like, no, I none of that sounds good.
I don't want to do any of that. Yeah. I can resonate with that because I was a youth pastor for about 2.5 years in Bible college. And then, like you say, I went off to work at this other church as a just as a drummer in the worship band. But you know, you got to work your way up the ladder, don't you? You've got to prove, as you say, and some of that makes sense, I guess. You're proving that you can teach kids and you can teach adults and all the rest of it. But yeah, if you're not cut out for that, man, there's a lot of people who don't, they're not happy.
Yeah, and I was good. I was good with the little kids, like up to like age 9 or 10, and then I was good with adults. It's that that large block in the middle that I was not good with at all. And I did, I was like, I remember I told a youth pastor who was like, yeah, you got to become a youth pastor. You need to, sit under me and let me train you. And I was like, but I didn't like high schoolers when I was in high school.
When I was one.
And I didn't like me either.
Yeah, what makes you think I'm going to be a good youth pastor?
And he was like, yeah, that could be a problem.
That could be a problem. Some people are cut out for that kind of work. I've got a buddy that I went to Bible college with. That dude is absolutely amazing when it comes to teens. He has a gift. I don't care what you call it, spiritual or whatever, but he has this ability to just connect with kids instantly. One time they came over here to visit, and we took him to a high school where he talked in this religious education class. I mean, to a bunch of British kids, this guy had him laughing. He had him eating out of the palm of his hand in about 30 seconds. And I was just in awe of what this guy could do with teenagers. He just has a gift, and he's always been in youth ministry. And you think, okay, I mean, that's where that's his niche, man. Yeah. I was not cut out to be that person, but yeah. You know, this guy clearly he is, isn't he?
Yeah. Right where he belongs. Right.
Yeah. That's and good. That makes sense, I guess, for him.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So you got your bachelor's degree in pastoral mm-hmm. studies.
Yep.
You were working at this church. Then what'd you do?
I went straight into seminary from Bible college. I didn't waste any time. I graduated in the spring of 97. And then in the fall of 97, I went straight on into an MA program at a nearby seminary in Portland. So I did that for another couple years. Then I took a few years off, worked at the church, upped my hours. I was actually getting paid by that point. And then I went back and did another degree at the same seminary, which was a THM, which is it's sort of in between an MA and a PhD. My goal at the time was I couldn't do a PhD then, but I wanted to get into academics. And I was told, look, if you do the THM degree, that will get you in the door of a Bible college or a seminary, which I then found out was completely untrue, because once I got the THM, I started putting out CVs and resumes all over the place. And they were like, where's your PhD? And I said, well, I was told this was as good as a PhD, but they said, no. I was going up against guys with PhDs with 10 years experience teaching, and I had nothing. So I couldn't get a job. That's what ended up me making this decision to do a PhD at some point, because I thought, I've got to get one. If I want to be in teaching in a Bible college or a seminary, you have to have it. The degrees I had just weren't quite good enough to get me in the door.
Right. So you're using these abbreviations, and most people have no clue what they mean. So THM is a master's in theology.
That's true.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Master in theology.
Remember, I don't have 1 second of college, so
right.
I don't know what they mean either.
It's kind of a progression of degrees. So when you get out, let's say you've done your undergraduate, like you say, you did your bachelor's degree, which I did. The MA, the Master of Arts, is kind of the next step up the chain. And then the THM, the Master of Theology, as I was told, is another level higher, where you're almost to a PhD level, but not quite. It's kind of in between a Master of Arts and a PhD, which, as I found out, as I say, it didn't mean anything. I did this 2-year degree and I had this piece of paper that said I was smart or whatever, you know, but I come to find out most of the people in my church, I mean, they didn't care if I could talk about Augustine or Aquinas or the Greek word for this, or they didn't care. What they wanted was actual help in their practical everyday lives. So all this academic stuff really didn't carry a whole lot of water in terms of actual pastoral ministry.
Right. Right. That was always the area where I was the most abrasive to pastors mm-hmm. that I was at their churches. I would, because, you know, I always focused on, okay, but people's lives are supposed to be getting better. You know, well, they are getting better as long as they keep giving me money. Right. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
and that's the thing. I think what saved me was having that background in the real world. Cause I, like you said, I'd been in the Navy. I've worked in construction. I've had real jobs. You know, I know what it's like to bust your ass on a job site every day. And I always tried to bring that into the ministry, where I'm resonating with the real person in the pew, so to speak, the guy who's working, the woman who's got a job or a career. And I wanted to make it actually applicable to their real lives. Even my PhD, that's why I did it in preaching, because I thought, well, I don't want to just do another biblical Old Testament study. There's millions of those. It doesn't matter. But I was trying to bring it back into pastoral ministry or practical theology. And it ended up blowing up in my face, like I say, because here comes this guy from this Bible college in London. And he's like, well, I would never preach this way. I wouldn't recommend this. This is crazy. What are you trying to do here? So it didn't work.
All right. And so that brings us to where you ended up making a radical change. You were in Portland, you were pastoring, and then you and your wife decided to take your family with it. At this point, you had two daughters. Is that
That's
right?
true. We still do. Yeah, we
Yeah.
haven't had it anymore.
Okay. And you had the family of four, and you decided to enter a doctoral degree in the UK.
Yes, we got
Okay.
out. But
So
it was a major life change because I've always loved to travel, and we used to go across to Belgium every couple of years. A friend of mine that I went to Bible college with, he was a pastor down in California, and he had these gigs playing for these youth groups of military kids that were stationed in Germany. And every year they'd take them to this amazing summer camp thing in Belgium, and we got to play that gig a couple times. And I'm over there in Belgium. We're driving around Germany, going down the Autobahn, and I'm like, you know what? Get me the hell out of here. I want to get out of America. This is amazing. I want to live somewhere in Europe. So I came back home from one of these trips. I told my wife, I'm like, we got to get out. We need to get out. And she said, well, I don't want to go to Germany or France or somewhere where we need to learn the language. So we settled on Great Britain because you could converse with somebody. Of course, they have British English and all the accents and everything, but at least they speak a form of English, I guess they would say. They mock us for our American, English, but you could at least converse with someone from here.
Right. And so what was the doctoral degree in again? What were you you went over
So
there?
I was always an Old Testament guy anyway. That's what I'd done my MA in. So I thought, well, I'll keep with that. I'll do the Hebrew study. So I did a study on the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament. But like I said, I added the preaching part. That was where my sort of practical theology I wanted to push that element of as well. I wanted it to have some sort of actual benefit for the pastor or the church leader to be able to make use of this all this work.
Okay, and with your work on it on Ezekiel, did that include LSD or magic mushrooms or anything to help you understand it?
You gotta wonder. It's funny because even the book of Ezekiel was part of my deconstruction because the more I studied it, the more I realized, I mean, the God of Ezekiel is really problematic. The stuff that he asks, if you just read the text, I'm not saying it's a historically accurate book or whatever, but if you just take it at face value, the character Ezekiel, the things that the God character has Ezekiel do. I mean, at one point he kills Ezekiel's wife and turns around and says, I'm going to kill your wife and you're not going to be allowed to mourn for her as an example to your fellow exiles because they're in Babylon in exile. And you think, what the hell? I mean, what kind of a God is this? And the thing about Ezekiel is, if you read the book, he's the only one who ever obeyed God. He didn't do anything wrong. He was trying to be an example as a prophet to his fellow exiles, who, according to the text, were into all this idolatry. And it's like, wait a minute, you're doing all the right things, and God turns around and kills your wife and
Yeah.
says you can't mourn for her. And I really struggle with that. I'm like, what kind of a God is this? This is deeply disturbing, really angry God and
Yeah.
vengeful to the people who are actually obeying him. That's shocking. That's really shocking.
Yeah, that's it.
It really is.
It's more than just inhumane. It's sadistic and just
It's
awful,
cruel.
and it always makes me think back to the very first sentence in Job. Job was a man who walked perfectly before God.
Exactly.
And then in that book, and again, I think it's fiction, but in that book, okay, now God invites Satan to absolutely destroy Job's life.
Over a cosmic bet.
Yeah, and
Literally, it's like the movie Trading Places, where Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy, their lives get completely destroyed, and then they come to find out it was all over a bet for a dollar.
Yeah.
They've destroyed their lives for a joke, for a bet, for
Yeah.
nothing. And yeah,
Yeah.
like you said, that book it's the same kind of theology, isn't it? Where you have a guy who is obedient, who is faithful. And God basically, like you said, let Satan destroy his entire life, including killing all of his children
Yeah.
over a bet, just to see whether or not he'll remain faithful. And he never, ever tells Job, the character Job, what's going on, why this happened to him. He never, and in fact, when Job tries to get some answers, God slaps him down, says, who are you to question me?
Yeah.
And we're supposed to be okay with that, you know? Yeah. So this is really problematic.
Yeah. I actually recently, one of my, old friends from the faith he's still in the faith. You know, I asked him a couple of questions and his response was, I don't get to judge God. And I said, well, that's fine. But if he's going to judge me, I get to judge him. That's the way the world works. And
turnabout's fair play, isn't it?
Yeah. He didn't like that answer. Because it's, you know, it's rebellious. It's whatever. But you know, you're just a mere human. You couldn't possibly fathom all the things that God has going on in his mind. Mm-hmm. Okay. But he at least has to live up to the same principles that he tries to hold me to.
Yeah. This is the problem. And this is why my deconstruction involves a great deal of the theological and biblical aspects of it. Because the more I studied it, like I'm saying with my example from Ezekiel, I would walk away and go, no, wait a minute. I mean, what are the implications here of my own beliefs in this God that I claim to serve? I have been serving as faithfully as I can pretty much my whole life, growing up in church, going to Bible college. And part of my desire to go to Bible college and seminary was to help people avoid some of the traumas that I had experienced as a kid growing up in that fundamentalist cult-like background. And I'm thinking, if I can learn the answers, if I can give them the biblical basis, the theological answers, they can maybe avoid some of that trauma that I experienced. And yet I'm uncovering this God who's deeply abusive, really. If you described it and said, this is a description of an abusive boyfriend, let's say, with a battered spouse or partner, that's kind of the God we're describing here. And I didn't know what to do with that. But I was deeply troubled by that. And I still am to this day. I'm really not sure what to think about that.
Yeah. And I had questions all the way along and I was taught very clearly that, you know, I wasn't that asking the types of questions that I asked wasn't appropriate. Right. And I remember the very first big question that I asked. I just said, you know, I was talking with some UPC, United Pentecostal Church pastors, and their thing is they don't believe in the Trinity. They believe in the Trinity, but they don't believe in the co-equality of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I hope we're not losing people here, but
get too far out of the weeds, man.
yeah. But I simply asked, is there anywhere in the New Testament that, you know, tells us about the Trinity? The first response was, oh, anytime you get into legalism, it's always bad. You need to avoid that stuff. Right. And I was like, wait, no, that I didn't ask anything about legalism. As a matter of fact, what your response is what sounds like legalism here. Right. And then the second person I asked was the honest answer. And it's there's nothing in the New Testament that directly speaks to that directly says the Trinity is the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But there's lots of things that help us infer that, including the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit all being listed together. Jesus saying the Father and I are one.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen me, you've seen the Father, you know, those types of things. And so, you know, the first person just went off on me and, cause you're not, you know, you've been given the spirit of questioning.
I rebuke that spirit.
Yeah, exactly. And then the second person gave me the honest answer is, it's not actually there, but we can infer it. So I was like, okay, thank you. That's all I needed. That's you're right.
Just a straight answer.
Yeah. But, as my career went along, I found that I asked way too many uncomfortable questions and when I started to really study theology, Charnock from the UK, from England.
Yes.
Is it Stephen Charnock? I believe it is.
I think we talked about it in our podcast.
Yeah. I studied his, Existence and Attributes of God, volumes 1 and 2. I got a lot out of that. And then there was another systematic, theology book that I bought that was just regular, how do you say it? It was just regular Protestant evangelical,
Mainstream.
yeah, systematic theology. And the all-knowing, all-powerful, everywhere present at all times, thing always messed with me because, okay, Jesus said God's our father, and Jesus's best friend, John, said God is love. And so if you put all-knowing, all-powerful, everywhere at all times, our Father and love, if you put those together, that does not describe the God of the Bible, and it does not describe the way our lives go here. And you know, shouldn't God be a better communicator than, say, Tony Robbins or Donald Trump, right?
One would hope. But
And
the problem, yeah, that's the problem, isn't it?
yeah, and apparently he's not. And that really started a downward spiral for me. Besides all the other questions that I just could never get answered. And you know, Job and Ezekiel, those are both books asking the questions of, you know, basically the one question: why do all these awful, horrible things happen to good people? If God is so good, if God's so wonderful and powerful, why does he allow this to happen to people he supposedly cares about and who care deeply about him and are incredibly faithful to him? Why? And there's just, I couldn't get any satisfactory answers.
Oh, there's always answers, Dean. Come on. I used to teach a class, a whole course called A Theology of Suffering. And the fact that you had to have a class on the theology of suffering with a week's worth of notes that you'd go through, an intensive week we used to do this class, and it was unbelievable because you think, wait a minute, why do we have to deconstruct this idea that God is allowing suffering and all that? That everything you just raised, isn't it? That you have to have what's called theodicy, which is basically a theological explanation for the problem of evil and why God allows suffering and all the rest of it. Man, there are so many rabbit trails that you can go down, the whole free will issue and all the rest of it. You think, wait a minute, the step back a little bit and say, why are we having to justify these really cruel actions of our God that we claim to serve? And this is the problem. I think about these people that sit in these church services every Sunday and they're singing all these happy, clappy songs about Jesus and God. Wait a minute, this is the God who ordered genocide in the Old Testament. He ordered his people to kill men, women, children, and animals. He took, you know, he screwed Job's life over for a cosmic bet. He took Ezekiel's wife, and on and on and on. And you have to somehow come up with some explanation for why that's all okay. He's doing it to help us build our faith, and he's helping us, you know, to come to a deeper understanding of him, and he's disciplining us because he loves us, and on and on. Those don't work for me anymore. I'm sorry, I don't believe it. I don't buy that.
Right. Yeah. All right. So you're in the UK, you're studying for your doctorate, and what happens next?
Well, a lot of things happened. I was already on this track before I even left to come over here. We were getting into real progressive Christian theology, guys like Brian McLaren, Donald Miller, Rob Bell, those kind of names. We were reading those books probably 2 years before, and I was really jettisoning a lot of my fundamentalist dogma that I had been raised to believe was true. And because I was going to so much seminary training and everything else, I'm being exposed to other traditions as well. And so I began to see, wait a minute, the tradition I was raised in was far from the only one. There's many, many, many streams of Christianity, many, many traditions. I'm just raised in this one fundamentalist narrow stream. And so I was deconstructing anyway. But by the time I got over here, I began to have real problems with the sort of like I said, the theological end of things. And my supervisor at the university I went to was really good because he would circle things on my thesis chapters in red pen. You know, I would write a sentence and it would be a pretty dogmatic kind of assertion about the way the Bible is interpreted or some theological point, and he would circle it. And then we'd have these meetings every month, And he would ask me, I'm like, well, why'd you circle that? What's wrong with that statement? And he would say, well, look, I mean, if you want to leave that in your thesis, you certainly can, but you're going to have to defend that somewhere. And do you want to do that? And I would be going back and looking at it and thinking, wait a minute, why did I write that? Why did I say that? Where's that coming from? That's my fundamentalism just kind of, you know, the presuppositions just coming straight out in my chapters that I was writing. And I thought, God, I really don't believe that. Why did I even say that? You know, so I would sort of delete these sentences and change things around. And it revealed to me how deep this programming, the indoctrination went, you know, that was my background. And it was just kind of coming out unchecked, I guess you could say. And he very, really gently called me on it in a real kind of, you know, non-confrontational way. So that was a really helpful process for 2 or 3 years going through that with him.
Wow. That's tremendous. And so you were talking about how there's many, many different traditions and streams in Christianity. And that's not counting all the ones that the early Roman government and Roman Catholic Church
stomped out, literally killed. Yeah, just destroyed.
Yeah.
And even the medieval period and everything else, the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
You know, so many traditions and sects and things that they labeled heresy, they literally wiped them out. Literally, man, woman, and children.
So there's a man he might not even be alive anymore, but he's from England, but he in college he converted to Eastern Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And I forget his name, but he got pretty high up there, and he wrote a book called Orthodoxy. And in that book, it's basically just a history. It's a brief history because it's under 300 pages. I read it several times. His name was Timothy something or other. Anyway, it's a brief history of the Eastern Orthodox Church. And he tells this story of how, the bishops in Istanbul, after it had been captured and converted from Constantinople into Istanbul, mm-hmm. The Russian Orthodox Church took over leadership of all the Orthodox churches, and they wanted to make sure that the Russian Orthodox Church was holding to the traditions. So they sent emissaries to Moscow to figure it out. And one of the emissaries wrote back, he said, it's awful. They even make children stand for hours praying. And these people, they're so dogmatic. They even forbid the smoking of opium.
Oh, that's a church service I could be a part of, man. You might need it to get through.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I remember reading that and thinking, yeah, how can you know Jesus if you aren't smoking opium?
Gotta smoke some dope, man. It's amazing. There's so many stories that come out of that, isn't there? That reminds me of, you know, when Constantinople was being threatened by the Turks, they sent word to the Western Church and asked for help. You remember this story? Mm-hmm. That's another one. And the Pope basically sent word back and he said, look, we'll help you if you agree to these terms, which is start having your services in Latin instead of Greek, and you've got to change your theology and on down the line. And they said, no, we're not going to do it. So the Pope basically shook his hand, you know, washed his hands of him and let the whole thing fall apart and refused to send armies to help him, you know, fellow Christians.
Yeah.
So this is the story of Orthodoxy, isn't it?
Yeah. 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 Just never wanting to submit to the Pope.
Yeah. They would not do it. Yeah. And so he, as a result, they let Constantinople, as it was then, get sacked by the Turks.
Yeah.
They couldn't agree on their theology.
Yeah.
Or wouldn't agree.
Which is just crazy, you know?
Yep.
I mean, I can't imagine, you know, my brother and I, we differ politically right now, right? We get in arguments and we don't talk to each other for a while because it gets too heated and whatnot. And I can't imagine him saying, hey, these people are coming to kill me. Will you help me? And it's, well, yeah, as long as you renounce Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All no, these conditions no, I'm attached. Just going to go help him.
Yeah, absolutely. Blood's thicker than water, man. But it wasn't in this case. They saw it as a chance to leverage their hegemony into the Eastern Orthodox Church.
Right.
They took a stand on principle, and as a result, they ended up getting destroyed.
Yeah.
So it was a lose-lose all the way around.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the part of the history of Christianity.
So you graduated, you got your doctorate, and you got a job teaching in a Bible college like you wanted.
I did. I was in. Yeah, I was in.
And your life is set, man. You're there. You got it.
That's just how great it was.
You're raking in the bucks as a
I was not raking in anything. I was getting paid very, very little. I used to have to travel up to Liverpool and Leeds every week, which was Leeds was like a 2.5 hour train ride each way. So I spent more time on the train going to Leeds to teach for 4 hours than I did actually teaching. I spent, you know, all this time going on the train, but that's the only job I could get. In this country, there's not a lot of Bible colleges, which I found out. That's part of why we ended up not going back to the States, because I thought, well, if I get a job here, that's my only chance, because there's thousands of seminaries and Bible colleges in America, but I've got a job here, but it's a really difficult market to break into. But yeah, I wasn't making any money. I could have done better just getting a regular job, but I saw that as a stepping stone. I'm thinking, well, I'm getting some experience so I can pad my CV out and say, look, I've been teaching for 5 or 6 or 7 years now, and I've got a PhD. Now I can finally get a job. But we didn't want to move back to the States by then, so we just ended up staying here, which was kind of a dead end for a career point of view.
And how long did you teach at that Bible college?
Well, I think I was there probably 7 or 8 years. I mean, I started off just teaching the odd class here and there, and then they thought, okay, this guy's okay. And they slowly gave me more and more and more classes. So at one point when I was really heavy involved in it for the last 3 or 4 years, I was teaching about 3 days a week. I would teach 2 days in Leeds, and then Fridays I'd go up to Liverpool. So it was a lot of train traveling, sitting on trains, going back and forth. But, you know, it was what I had to do. Plus, I enjoyed the teaching.
What did you do on the trains? I'm just curious.
Oh, man. Well, my whole way there, I was reviewing my notes and checking to make sure I had everything, you know, set up, because you have all your handouts and all that stuff for the class. But then on the way back, I'd listen to my music. I'd sit there, read books on the train. It's just one of those things. You get used to it. They have a much better infrastructure as far as travel in this country. So it's a lot easier to get around than it is in America, for sure. Plus, it's a tiny country anyway. You can be from top to bottom in about 12 hours, you know, so it's very small.
Okay. And all right. So while you were teaching at the Bible college, you were what you call deconstructing.
I was.
And you were already deconstructing when you were getting your doctorate degree.
That's
so
true.
Tell us a little bit about what that entails. What was going on?
Well, the problem that it presented with teaching, there was a couple of things. One thing was their model, because this Bible college is based out of Birmingham in the Midlands, which is kind of in the middle of the UK. And they have about, I don't know, 6 or 7 regional centers dotted around the country. So that's why I had to travel to Leeds and Liverpool, and then Manchester as well. They had other centers that opened up. And so everybody had to use the same set of notes. So there'd be these head guys down in Birmingham. They would write all the notes for the whole course, and you had to teach off of their notes. So you weren't using your material. You were using their stuff. Now that became a problem, because I didn't agree with a lot of the stuff that they were saying. So, but I had to produce the same learning outcomes for every class session. So I started departing from the notes more and more and more, but I was still hitting the learning outcomes. And they tolerated me for a long time, because they could see the students were engaged and we were having really good discussions. But I basically jettisoned the notes, which kind of proved to be a problem, because I wasn't singing off that same hymn sheet after a while. So that was an issue, as well as just not believing half the material and half the theology they were pushing, or wanted me to push, I should say.
Okay. And when did that really, when did you stop going to church?
Well, I wasn't going to church the whole time I was teaching there.
So yeah. Once you moved to the UK, you never found a church?
We did, though. When we first moved here, we went to a church. It was a very charismatic church. They're actually affiliated, I later found out, with Rick Joyner and some of that stuff going on. We had several people go across to his quote-unquote school of supernatural ministry or wherever it is. And they were part of a big organization, very charismatic. So we had tongues and prophecies and interpretations of tongues and all that. That was a regular part of the services. But we went there
They
for probably
had
3 years.
they had a fantastic worship training. They had tons and tons of great musicians who were worship leaders in the worship bands, those types of things. I'm very familiar with Rick Joyner and Morningstar Ministries.
So we had people, they went over there, did his school of ministry, came back to the UK and started up a similar deal where it was all about going out into town, prophesying over people, healing people with a view towards evangelizing them by healing them. So that was their model of ministry. And that was part of the difficulty we had. I mean, I was raised in a what's called a cessationist church. So we didn't believe in the gifts of tongues, the gifts of miracles, healings. We didn't believe any of that. So it was a real kind of eye-opening experience to start going to this super charismatic church. But we ended up leaving there probably about three and a half years in while I was still doing my doctorate. So by the time I got the gig at the Bible college, we had left that church and I didn't go to church at all, which was a really awkward conversation because students would always ask me, "So what church do you go to?" And I'd say, "I don't go to church." You know, so they're like, "How could you be a teacher at a Bible college and you don't even go to church?" So that was an awkward conversation.
And how would you usually wiggle out of that?
Well, to be technical, we were involved in a church plant. So my answer always was, no, we don't go to a formal church, but we're planting a church. We're involved in a church planting organization, which was true. They ended up sponsoring us for the last 3 years we were here on our visa, which was very helpful because that got us over the 10-year mark so we could then apply for indefinite leave to remain and stay in the country. So we were planting a church, you could say, for the last 3 years or so of our time here.
And how did that church go?
It didn't. Basically, the short answer, the it was all about just building community. And so I had a lot of friends and we'd do stuff. We'd go to pubs, but they, you know, we'd hang out, we'd talk about spirituality. I played American football on a team, a local team here for about 8 seasons. I built tremendous amounts of relationships. Those were my quote unquote mission field. And so I was being missional. That was their word. And yet I never had anything to show for it at the end of the day. I couldn't say, I've got a church of 20 people and we meet every week here, there, and everywhere. I was building relationships. That was my model of evangelism at the time.
The way it was done in the New Testament mostly.
That was my thought. Yeah. And that's what I would say. And that's the model I was teaching my students. I would say, listen, I'm not going to, and this was going back to my sort of bent toward practical theology, I would say, look, I'm not going to tell you to do anything I'm not myself doing. I have most of my friends, probably 95% of them are non-Christians, and that is by design. I did not want to be in a church bubble. So my quote unquote church that I planted was me going out playing American football or playing in a metal band in North Wales and playing in pubs and clubs and having conversations with people about spirituality, you know, and that's what I would tell the students. I'd say, look, I'm 100% authentic. I'm not going to bullshit you. I'm not going to be up here telling you, hey, you need to go out and preach the gospel when I'm not myself doing it as a lifestyle. So that was my kind of model of evangelism or church planning, I guess you could say at the time. And so that's where I felt like I had that credibility. I could say, look, I'm modeling it for you. This is how you do it. You don't just build a church building and expect people to come in. You got to be out there actually talking to people about their issues and problems. And if the gospel has anything to offer, then let's make sure that it actually does make a difference. But then I came to see that it didn't, I couldn't sell it, you know? So I quit doing that as well.
Okay. And then at what point did you finally at what point did you finally decide, okay, or maybe you haven't yet, so I don't know, but at what point did you finally decide, okay, I just don't believe this anymore. I'm not actually a Christian.
Yeah, I would say, well, what happened was I ended up getting laid off from the Bible college, and it wasn't because they were unhappy with my teaching or whatever. They ran out of money. Essentially, they ran themselves into huge debt, and they made a bunch of us, what they say in this country is they make you redundant, which is basically being laid off. And so almost all of the teachers that were working there got laid off, got made redundant. And then I said, they did me a favor, actually, because I was having a harder and harder time, you know, parroting that party line anyway. So that was kind of the end of my last formal involvement with academics from a theology Bible point of view. I've never taught in a Bible college or seminary since then. I had no desire to. I would say I'm probably more of an agnostic. I'm not a full-blown atheist. I have serious doubts and questions, but I don't know what I'm not sure what I believe as far as when it comes to God, but I have a lot of questions, a lot of problems, as we were talking about before. And I love talking about those with other people who are interested in it, because it helps them to kind of work through their own issues as well.
Yeah. Okay. And how long have you been in that mode?
Oh, a long time. I think the last, I can point to one definitive date when Trump got elected, and I had been tracking that, the candidacy of Trump and seeing the evangelical support for him in the States when he got elected. And I saw that 81% of white evangelicals voted for him and obviously have continued to support him over the terms of his presidency. When he got elected, I said, that's it. I am no longer calling myself a Christian. I do not want to be associated with that. Whatever that is, has nothing to do with what I thought Christianity was. I considered myself a Christian for a long time. I was barely on the bubble. I was on the fringe, man, the lunatic fringe. And that was my last, absolute last straw. No way did I want to be a part of that.
Okay. And I've seen the last few days, I've started seeing people with the jokes. Are you a Christian? You want to tell me about Jesus? Is it Republican Jesus or regular Jesus?
That's right. White American Jesus. There's a podcast with that name, I believe. Yeah.
What name?
Something like, straight white American Jesus.
Oh, I'm supposed
to be, talking to that guy.
It's got to be a lefty. That's got to be a lefty.
It's a great name, though.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And so did this cause problems in your marriage, in your family?
Marriage, no. Family, yes.
Okay.
So luckily for me, both my wife and I were on the almost exactly the same journey, deconstructing. We were reading those books when I was still a pastor. And so we were getting out of our sort of belief system years and years ago. So we've been on that same path. Luckily, we both kind of deconstructed at the same time for slightly different reasons. I mean, she was raised in Christian high school, but she didn't have any of the background I had in fundamentalism. Her parents became Christians when she was in high school. So she doesn't have all the religious trauma, or to the same extent that I do. She has different RTS than I do, but we were lucky there. But my family in the States, some of them have disowned me. My oldest sister has completely disowned me, partially because our oldest daughter is gay and partially because I'm a complete apostate now. So she can't have anything to do with me. She's a total fundamentalist. And so she's just blocked me on Facebook and shut me out of her life and whatever. It is what it is.
I'm sorry to hear that. I know you've recently on a few recent episodes, you've talked about Hank Kuhneman here in the States. Mm-hmm. He's a prophet out of Omaha. And I can tell you that I don't know about now, but the by the way, the Kenneth Copeland laughing video, that's at Hank's church.
Oh, is it?
I helped build that building. In the first 5 or 10 years, I know, at least 5, if not 10, they at Hank's church, they practiced shunning. It was
sure.
Anybody who left, it didn't matter why they left. Anybody who left, you are not to speak to them or fellowship with them. And so they were splitting families up and all kinds of stuff. And they were like, no, they left. They mm-hmm. You can't have anything to do with them. It was pretty harsh, man.
Absolutely. Well, I was going to say there's been two major, well, three, I guess, major developments in my life over the last probably 3 years. One of which, the first one is, I realized that for a long time I was just angry at the church. I was angry at God and I was just lashing out. And then I did a live podcast with a friend of mine when I was in Seattle a few years ago, Stacy Ray, and she came down from Vancouver and we did this live podcast. We talked a lot before I went over to Seattle. We would chat on Facebook Messenger, and we realized that we need to stop being so angry. It's counterproductive. And we kind of came up with this idea. We called it reconstruction after deconstruction. And that was, I see now, that was a huge life change for me because I was spending a lot of time just being angry. And then I started studying cult psychology. That's what happened to me. That was the second major change, was I began to apply the things I was learning about the world of the cults and sociology and cult experts to my own experience growing up. And that was a huge eye-opener to me. So I did a lot of episodes with cult experts, people like Rick Ross, Janya Lalich, Marlene Whannell, people like that who come out of that religious trauma background. And then the last thing was I started studying Dominion theology, and that's what I've been working on for the last year, year and a half. And that's been a whole eye-opening thing to me, seeing what the Christian right has been doing for the last, I don't know, four or five decades at least, and that I was a part of that movement, even in a small way. But I was a cog in the machine. I was a pawn on the chessboard, as it were, in that movement. And so those three developments have been a huge, been, I can see now they've been big turning points in my life. So for me doing the podcast, I only like to share what I'm personally learning. That's kind of my whole model, going back to what I was talking about as a teacher. I don't want to tell someone something I don't know anything about because I haven't studied it myself. And I just want to share that with the world. You know, that's my, because I'm wired as a teacher, you know, so that's kind of why I do what I do. Long answer.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Can you explain, 'cause I didn't go through this. Why, when you stopped being a Christian, why were you mad at God?
Well, I was mad at God and I was mad at everybody who introduced me to the whole thing. So my parents, the pastor, the church, the whole system, because I realized that I had been traumatized as a child and as an adult, and I was part of perpetuating the trauma in other people's lives. And I kept thinking to myself, wait a minute, if this God is this supposedly loving, kind of what you were talking about earlier, the God of the Bible, the loving God, how can he allow this to develop? How has the church become what it's become? This toxic, abusive system where kids are sexually abused and, you know, people are traumatized, spiritually abused, religious trauma syndrome. How the hell is God okay with that? Why isn't he stepping in to do something about it? That's a huge problem, you know? And I was angry with people who I felt they didn't do their due diligence because they were lying to me. Yes, they believed it wholeheartedly, but it wasn't true, the stuff they were telling me. So you've got to work through all those levels, kind of like peeling back the layer of the onion. Every layer leads to more tears and more issues because you go, my God, I thought I was done with this stuff. No. It's a lifelong process of deconstructing. It really is.
I was angry at God numerous times while I believed.
Yeah, so was I.
But I noticed shortly after I just stopped believing, I was on the phone with a friend, and he said, this apologist guy, he says this, my friend isn't the apologist. He was quoting an apologist. He said that guy says atheists are just mad at God for not existing. And I said, dude, you have a master's degree. I don't have 1 second of college. Think about what you just said. Are you pissed off at Bugs Bunny for not existing? And he's like, yeah, I guess that is kind of silly, isn't it, Dean? I was like, yeah, it is. And I said, I have not been mad at God since I admitted to myself I don't believe in him. I don't believe that God exists, so I can't possibly be angry with him. But I was very angry with the church with evangelicals, especially going whole hog in for Trump and just flat out worshiping him. I know they all deny it, but they worship him. Whatever he says is true. You know, God says it, I believe it, that settles it, right? Mm-hmm. That's them with Trump. And I figured out last year in 2019, I finally figured out, you know, why are you so angry with these people? And it was because I no longer believe that they're filled with the Holy Spirit of truth, but mm-hmm. I was still expecting them to act like they were filled with the Holy Spirit of truth. That's completely unfair. that's a standard. You just, you know, I don't believe that you can possibly live up to this standard because it doesn't exist, but I'm going to hold you to it anyway. I mean, just, and I had to, I still get angry at believers for their ridiculous support of Trump, but it's not nearly as much anymore.
And this is the thing. There's so many levels to what you just described. I mean, you could add to it too, can't you? The fruit of the Spirit is a famous passage in the book of Galatians, isn't it? The Christians, if they are empowered by that Holy Spirit, the loving God, they are supposed to exhibit these wonderful series of traits, character traits in their lives. They're supposed to be loving and peaceful and patient and joyful and these are all the fruits of the Spirit. And yet Christians can be some of the most hate-filled, nasty, horrible, gossiping, slandering, backstabbing people I've ever met. And that's coming from 12 years as a pastor and getting screwed over in church politics. And you think, how you got to trace that back to the God that's supposedly behind all of this. How is that possible? You know, and then you start plugging in the cult psychology, which mm-hmm. is the shunning you described and all the other pieces that you can put in there. And you think, God, this is a very toxic system that abuses people. It really does. And we have to now pick up the pieces of years and years of religious trauma. And like I said, some people have had sexual abuse and spiritual abuse and all this. They've got to deal with all that from the church.
Mm-hmm.
How's that possible? And God's supposedly behind all this, a loving God.
Yeah. You know where I've had much more trouble with this than with God, is actually, being angry at all of my history teachers and everything I learned in school about mm-hmm. the United States of America.
Yeah.
How it's almost all propaganda and just flat out lies and just made up mythology. Yeah. And that's where I have a much, much harder time. I was, you know, for me, it was a weight off my shoulders when I admitted, okay, I no longer believe in that this God exists. Right. And it just, this huge weight off my shoulders. I was no longer scared all the time. But the finding out how disgusting and horrible the government of my country is and the reasons why, has been much more traumatic for some reason.
Well, but you can put the pieces together. And I think, you know, there's so many people that are doing amazing work. For example, Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead. If people haven't heard of this book, it's called Taking America Back for God. And I've had both of them on the show last year. And what they've done is an actual sociological study. They wanted to understand what was the most dominating driving factor in why evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. And the overriding number one reason is Christian nationalism. That by far, if the more likely you are to believe in Christian nationalism, which is that myth of a Christian America that you just said, the more likely you were to vote for Donald Trump. And that myth has been promoted mostly by the church and guys like, you know, people like David Barton of Wall Builders. He's one of the biggest names. He's a quote historian who goes all over the country and he speaks in the Capitol and all over Washington, D.C. He was at the recent rally in D.C. He's everywhere. He's like the Where's Waldo of the historical quote unquote Christian world. And he's promoted this myth. And so Christians believe it. And it's just been promoted and promoted. And it's ingrained now in the system. It's just become part of the DNA that's baked into the evangelical church in America. And they're the ones who are promoting that.
Yeah. And because Texas sets the standard for most textbooks in public schools around the country. And there's specific reasons for that, but that we can't get into. But it gets taught all through our public schools. Like it's literal history when it's just made up.
It is. In fact, that's another good point, because David Barton was heavily involved for years. He's from Texas himself, Aledo, Texas, and he was heavily involved in the Texas State School Board of Education promoting that myth of Christian nationalism in those textbooks. There's a really good book called The Good News Club by Catherine Stewart, and she talks about that. It's basically an assault on public schools in America by the Christian right. And that's a whole nother piece. That's why the Dominion theology piece to me is so important, because this is what the Christian right has become, this power mad, money grubbing system that seeks to build a theocracy in America and the world, really, not just in America. Mm-hmm. It's actually a dangerous thing. It's a threat. It's gone beyond just saying, I've got some problems with that local church down the street. No, these guys are a threat to democracy. They're part of promoting Trump's conspiracy theories about the election fraud and all the rest of it, all these prophets that got it wrong. They're doubling down, you know? So these guys are actually a threat. They're promoting Michael Flynn's theory that Trump should declare martial law.
Yeah.
That is a threat. That is terrifying. Sedition. It's terrible. And that's the Christian right that's doing that. Yeah, not just Trump.
And these Christians are completely ignoring, literally completely ignoring, that Michael Flynn and his son, before he went to work for the Trump administration, Michael Flynn and his son were literally entertaining a job for the Turkish president, Erdogan, of kidnapping one of my neighbors, taking him out of the United States and handing him over to Erdogan to be tortured and probably murdered. Mm-hmm. Right. They were like, yeah, we'll do that for money. I'm like, wait, how can you be a Christian and support that guy?
Yeah. But they're supporting Trump, you know? So this is the thing, is people are sounding the alarm, you know, like I say, Sam Perry, Andrew Whitehead, Catherine Stewart, Kristen Dumais, her book, Jesus and John Wayne, is another excellent resource, because she basically argues that decades and decades of biblical patriarchy and toxic masculinity in evangelicalism is what laid the groundwork for that. Like you said, that worship of Trump, he's the ultimate tough guy figure that they've been pushing for years in their churches. So we've got a toxic system that actually has laid the groundwork for the cult of Trump, which is essentially what it's become.
All right, so let's talk about what is, you know, you have been very lucky. You and your wife are still together. This hasn't cost your marriage. This hasn't broken up your marriage, and you and your wife and your daughters all still have great relationships as well. Mm-hmm. So that's a wonderful position to be in, because this process often costs a lot of people. More than it's already cost you. What is next for you guys? What's next for you?
For me?
Yeah.
I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. That's the thing. I do love what I'm doing. Talk to people like you, talking to anyone who'll talk to me, I'll talk to them, you know? So in 2021, my aim is I'm going to do a new series called Profiles of the Christian Right. So I'm going to start focusing on key individual people, leaders within different organizations and within different movements, and talking to experts who know who these people are and start warning people of the dangers that they represent. So that's where I'm going in 2021, down this rabbit hole. Personally, that's what excites me, doing the research and seeing where it leads.
Okay. All right. And then, I think we're going to end it there. I think that's a really good place to stop. I encourage everybody to, I'll do that post. All right. So, tell everybody how they can reach you, how they can find you, Clint.
The best place is probably to find me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can also look me up on the MindShift Podcast Facebook page. I'm on Instagram as well, but I say, you know, if you follow me on Twitter or send me a DM, I'm really pretty active there. I'll respond to you and we can chat, we can dialogue if you have any thoughts, questions, comments about what we were talking about.
Sounds good. And I highly recommend the Mind Shift podcast. It's excellent. And it's a good way to start finding if you've walked out of evangelicalism or the charismatic side of evangelicalism, Clint's program, the Mind Shift podcast, is an excellent place to start to help you begin to find your way and find other people who have experienced the same things, which is always, it's almost always a good way to begin healing.
It really is. It's a journey, isn't it? And as you said before, having that tribe, that new community. So I'm looking forward to having you back in February because that community that we've been able to form of ex-evangelicals, ex-religious people in our, Facebook group, you're going to meet those people. And so that's all part of this whole movement, isn't it? Is networking and getting to know each other.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to that. I think it's like, well, I can't remember the exact date, but it is in February.
It's in February. That's all I know at this point. We don't have to worry about the actual date. We'll look at the calendar
Yeah.
when we get closer. Okay. Thank you, Dean.
All right. Thanks for being here, Clint. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to next time.
Absolutely. See you in February.
You got it. Now you've met Dr. Clint Haycock. I hope you check out his podcast, the Mind Shift Podcast, everywhere that podcasts are heard. Please check it out. I think it's definitely informative. You will learn a lot. And if your experience is anything like mine in life, you will find a lot of resources, a lot of healing, and a lot of answers to questions that you may or may not know you have. So there you go. Check him out. Dr. Clint Haycock, the Mind Shift Podcast. Please make sure you check us out next time to find out about the next person I meet.